Hi, and welcome to This is True Crime, y'all. This is a true crime podcast with a Texas twist. And thank you, everyone, for all of your feedback, good or bad. I could say I had a lot of both. Some of you don't like how slow I speak, but I do like to pronunciate, so that's probably not going to end anytime soon. One person suggested you play it on 1.5 times speed on Spotify. So there you go. So this case is the Bruce McKay and Leeko Kinney case. And this is a routine traffic stop that ends in murder in a truly bizarre turn of events. Now, what should have been a routine turned into a bloodbath with multiple deaths, shooters, innocent bystanders, and vigilante justice. We're going to discuss one of the events leading up to this main altercation that ends tragically for these two men. Get ready for a wild ass ride. This episode is like camping. It's intense. I know, corny. I love it. The first thing we're going to discuss is just the first encounter of many between Leeko Kinney and Bruce McKay. These events ultimately lead to the bad blood between these two and carries on until it escalates and leads to both of their demise. It was late in January 2003 that Leeko Kinney had his first encounter with Bruce McKay. It happened near the entrance to Franconia's Fox Hill Park, where McKay comes across Kinney parked alone in his mother's car, reclining in his seat. McKay approaches Kinney's window and asks to see his license. Kinney demanded to know why. He was just sitting there in a public parking lot. Then he leaped from his car and launched into a large argument with the officer. McKay's tone remained measured and authoritarian, as usual. Kinney's turned heated, combative even. "Leeko was always talking like that," says Gene McLean, who runs a flower store. "I kept telling him he had to pipe down." Kinney got back into his car and tried to drive away, but McKay brought his car nose to nose with Kinney's, blocking his path. After a few tense moments, the younger man backed his car off, but he wasn't done shouting at the cop. McKay, who had by this time called in 3 more officers, pulled out his pepper spray. When the backup arrived, the 4 of them tried to subdue a very snappy, very angry Kinney. A video camera mounted on McKay's cruiser recorded the confrontation as the officers maneuvered Kinney around to the far side of the car, which just happened to be out of the camera's view. On the tape, you can hear Kinney screaming at the officers that they are torturing him by twisting his neck. As he struggled, Kinney grabbed McKay's groin and began squeezing. McKay says he responds by striking him in the side of the head. In other words, he punched him in the damn head. When it was over, Kinney was taken in handcuffs to the hospital, where an evaluation revealed no injuries beyond some swelling around his jaw. He was charged with assaulting Officer McKay and was released into his parents' custody on $2,000 bail. Soon after, Kinney was cruising his uncle's trail again on his ATV. That April, Bill, fed up, called the cops. One of the responding officers was Bruce McKay, who found that Leeko Kinney had strapped a blowgun and steel darts to his ATV, in full violation of his bail agreement. He was put under house arrest and fitted with an ankle bracelet, which he promptly cut off, and earned himself 15 days in the county jail. After Leeko Kinney got out, Bruce McKay kept a close eye on him. He would drive down to Kinney's house, slowly turn around, and shine his high beams into the property, just to, quote, say hello. "I used to be able to set my clock by it," said neighbor Connie McKenzie, who saw McKay pass by her house, headed for Easton every single day. Bill Kinney, 56, later said that the run-in changed Leeko and that his nephew started carrying a weapon because he feared Bruce McKay. Other residents say they feared Bruce McKay as well, and we'll talk about that later in the episode. But Leeko Kinney got himself a High Point 45. He loved the gun. Sometimes he would keep it underneath his pillow at night. Sometimes he fired it into the air at parties, just for the fun of scaring everyone. When the High Point disappeared from his house one day, he was furious. He was also sure he knew who took it, his 15-year-old cousin who'd been in Kenny's room not long before. Kenny said he could tell by the way his PlayStation power cable was coiled up in the same configuration his cousin, who could be strangely methodical, always used. Kenny charged over to the main lodge where his cousin was staying and demanded the gun back. The cousin insisted he didn't know anything about it. The two grappled, Kenny nearly strangling the kid before regaining his wits. "If I don't get my gun back," he yelled on the way out, "I'll break your legs." When the High Point still hadn't turned up 4 days later, Kenny called the state police. Trooper Brett Beausoleil, I hope I said that right, was dispatched to interview the boy, who, according to police records, eventually confessed that he and a friend had indeed slipped into Kenny's home, stealing an X-rated DVD, along with the pistol. He also told Beausoleil about Kenny's violent reaction. A few days later, Kenny called Beausoleil to say that his gun had been returned and everything was fine. But in fact, his problems were just beginning. When Beausoleil asked him about the fight with his cousin, Kenny answered that he just shook him up a bit. The trooper, unswayed, called the boy's guardians, Woody and Holly Miller, telling them that if they didn't swear out an assault complaint, he would be forced to file one himself. The Millers couldn't bring themselves to turn against a relative, leaving Beausoleil to keep his word, which he did. Kenny's trial was put on the books for that April. The looming hearing made Kenny feel even more alienated. He already wouldn't go to the local bars. He was afraid people were looking to beat him up. He told his new boss at Agway that he was being followed, whether by McKay or just some kids, he wasn't for sure. Kenny's family worried that he might be suicidal and sent a friend over to talk with him. Kenny insisted he'd never kill himself, but he did say that Corporal Bruce McKay was driving him crazy. The trial did begin, and Beausoleil subpoenaed Kenny's cousin and Holly Miller and compelled them to testify. He secured a guilty verdict. For Kenny, that meant a $250 fine and a fresh supply of rage against the police. He had been victimized again. His house had been broken into, his gun stolen, and yet he gets punished? Afterward, Kenny started pulling away from even his closest friends. It was around that time he was overheard grumbling about taking matters into his own hands, and he started keeping a day planner inscribed with the words, "My last days." And this next part is where it truly blows my mind how things can just escalate into a situation that I'm pretty sure no one could have seen coming. I mean, it's mind-boggling, and you'll see why. If you haven't heard of this case, just hold the fuck on, because wowzers. It's just after 6 o'clock on the evening of May 11th, 2007. Leeko Kenny was headed down Route 116 bound for Easton in his banged-up 1984 Toyota Celica. We all know those things run forever. Route 116 is a ribbon of pitted asphalt that runs through tiny Franconia, known for what's left of the Old Man of the Mountain, and past the massive Canyon Mountain Ski Resort and into the wilds of neighboring Easton. The 24-year-old had just clocked out at the local Agway, where he'd been working there for just about a month, and felt he fit in well. Friends said he never seemed happier. In the car with him was his co-worker and roommate, a yoga enthusiast named Caleb McCauley. They had a handle of vodka and some cranberry juice, and shit was about to get lit because they were going to call a few friends over for a party. Also on board were two plastic bags of koi and goldfish that they were excited to get into a pond at their house. Kenny had just rounded the wide turn that locals call the Big Corner when he spotted the police Tahoe coming down the other side of the road. As the SUV drew closer, Kenny could make out its driver. Of course, Corporal Bruce McKay. Who else would it be, okay? He had been feuding with him for years, and not looking for another run-in, he slowed his Celica to the speed limit. You know, like you do when you see a cop and you're speeding. As their vehicles passed each other, McKay says that he noticed Kenny's registration sticker was expired. I've seen the video, and I have to wonder how he could have spotted that. I am no police officer. Perhaps he did. But it seems kind of sketchy to me. He swung his SUV around and hit the lights and sirens. It didn't take long for him to chase Kenny down and pull him over. He climbed out of his truck and approached the driver's side window, walking with his usual swagger. According to comments McCauley would later make in a police interview, McKay got right down to business, as usual, asking Kenny for his license and registration, and without offering any reason for the stop. Kenny refused, insisting that another officer be summoned, in accordance with the agreement he'd struck with the Franconia Police Department after that previous incident we had talked about. But that wasn't his decision to make, McKay told him. Increasingly distressed, Kenny placed 3 cell phone calls during the next couple of minutes. No one picked up. Then he takes off, kicks up fucking dirt with his tires, and says, "We're going to my uncle's house, so there'll be witnesses." McKay gets back into his SUV, revs the engine up, and gives chase once again. Kenny got a good jump on McKay when he tore away from the spot near Big Corner where the officer had stopped him. He was sure he could make it to Tamarack before McKay caught up. But about a mile and a half down the road, just past the McKenzie house and a few hundred yards short of the Easton line, Kenny saw McKay's SUV looming in his rearview mirror. McKay shot ahead of the Celica, angled it in front of it, and hit the brakes, forcing Kenny to hit his brakes as well. Then McKay slowly turns his Tahoe around in a multi-point turn to where he was facing Kenny and his car head-on in the middle of the road. He motioned for Kenny to back up onto a dirt patch by the McKenzie's barn. Lico Kenny did what the officer told him, and after he came to a stop, McKay nosed his Tahoe into the Celica's path once again. Its big chrome fender pressing up against the small vehicle's hood, locking the two vehicles in a kiss. This time, though, neither man would back down. McKay rammed Kenny's car once, twice. You can see this in the video. In my opinion, it was totally unnecessary. He did not need to hit this man's car. He already had him blocked in. "No," Kenny screamed. "No, stop pushing my car." After forcing Kenny back 20 feet, McKay nudged the Celica up against a massive front-end loader that Connie McKenzie's husband had parked there previously. McKay gets out of his Tahoe, comes around to the driver's side of the Celica, did not say one fucking word, raises his arm and blasts a giant stream of pepper spray through the open window and into Kenny's face. Then he just lowers the canister and walks away. As Corporal Bruce McKay walks away, Kenny reaches down to the floor and picks up his treasured High Point .45. He swings the gun towards McKay, his eyes still streaming and crying from the spray of the pepper spray, fires off 7 shots blindly. 1 passes cleanly through McKay's forearm, and 4 others hit McKay in the side. In an unusual break from character, Bruce McKay was not wearing his bulletproof vest. He always wore his vest, except on this fateful day. Dripping blood, he stumbles across the road and tries to tug his gun from its holster. But as he does, the bloodied weapon slips from his hand. Liko Kenny blindly revs his car forward and strikes the officer. Then he backs up and strikes him again, this time plowing the front end of the Celica up over McKay's torso on the ground. The small car rode so low, its undercarriage got stuck on the officer's body, leaving it rested there as if it was snagged on a log. Caleb McCauley would later say he thought Kenny was trying to escape and had only accidentally crashed into McKay. Unfortunately, the preponderance of the testimony and the official report suggest otherwise. It suggests that Kenny was trying to bury Bruce McKay and smash him into the dirt. Just a few minutes earlier, a dusty Silverado pickup coming down Route 116 from Franconia slowed to a stop at the site of McKay's Tahoe and Kenny's Celica facing off in the road. This truck was driven by teenager Gregory P. Floyd. In the passenger seat was his father, Gregory W. Floyd, a gnarled backwoodsman with deep-set eyes and Coke bottle glasses. When Kenny's gun came out and McKay went down, the elder Floyd jumped out of the cab. Apparently without pausing to see whether the officer was alive, he pulls McKay's weapon from the grass, checks to make sure it's still loaded, walks over to Kenny's Celica passenger side window, and he can see Kenny frantically working to clear a bullet that had jammed in his gun's chamber. Floyd shoots Kenny. His first shot rains glass on McCauley and tears through Kenny's neck. His second strikes Kenny in the head. McCauley, crouching in his seat, said he could feel the bullets whistling over his back. He sits up to find Floyd pointing McKay's gun at his head. He later said that Floyd yells at him to pick up Kenny's gun and that he refused, fearing Floyd would shoot him if he did. Floyd orders McCauley out of the car. He unbuckles his seatbelt and collapses onto the ground. He sits there on the ground, terrified and in shock, as Floyd takes off his shirt to make a tourniquet for Bruce McKay, and then fishes Kenny's gun out of the car. Floyd was still brandishing both of these weapons when Philip Blanchard, an officer from the nearby town of Sugar Hill, arrives at the scene. After Blanchard yells at Floyd several times to set the guns down, Floyd finally says, "Easy, son, I'm quicker than you." By then, rescue workers from surrounding towns had begun to arrive. With their help, Floyd and Blanchard lifted the Celica off of Bruce McKay's body. Connie McKenzie, who works as a nurse, arrived next. She performed CPR on McKay until the EMTs took over. She said, "I wanted to check on Kenny too, but I was ordered not to. I thought someone should at least take his pulse," she says. Kenny's body remained belted into the driver's seat while police swarmed the scene, collecting evidence and interviews, and no one ever checks on him. Bruce McKay was rushed to the hospital, where he was later pronounced dead. The day after the shootings, New Hampshire Attorney General Kelly Ayotte, who has jurisdiction over all murders in the state, concluded that Floyd's use of deadly force appeared to be justified. New Hampshire Governor John Lynch also issued a statement decrying the senseless tragedy of McKay's killing. One area policeman declared that Floyd deserved a medal. Floyd seemed to be feeling the same way. He made a rare visit to the village store that day to buy some newspapers, which were sold out, in which he proclaimed, "I'm the guy who shot that kid." In the politicians' rush to absolve Floyd, they may have glossed over a few things. Like, minutes after the police arrived, Floyd claimed that Kenny was the 43rd person he'd killed. Later that night, in a police interview, he said he worked for the government in places and things you can't talk about. Floyd had also been found guilty of selling marijuana and PCP in Georgia. Felony convictions that made it illegal for him to own the two firearms that he kept stashed in his house up in the deep woods of Easton, where a chain hangs across his driveway and at least one snarling Rottweiler patrols the grounds. According to police records in 1997, Floyd threatened to sic his dog on a utility meter reader who'd come onto his property. When state troopers showed up to arrest him, he tried to force them off his land by sending his son for a gun, shouting, "I know you wear Veets, so I would have to put it right between your eyes." During the ensuing scuffle, Floyd incurred another charge for trying to knee one of the officers in the groin. He was found guilty of attempted assault and received 3 years probation and a suspended prison sentence. Bill Kenny is among one of many who theorized that Floyd was an informal backup for Bruce McKay, who operated on a kind of a buddy system. The two lived not too far apart and seemed to share a similar outlook on the world. Floyd refuses to speak to the press, but some in Franconia also speculate that he kept a police scanner, which would have let him track McKay's movements. In any case, on this day, on Route 116 in a rural town, he was judge, jury, and executioner. Okay, here we go. This video is 7 minutes and 21 seconds long, and we're starting. It shows the police officer backing out of somewhere and onto a road. I assume he's just seen Liko Kenny and is turning around to pursue him. It's a winding country road by the looks of it. You know, he hasn't caught up to Liko just yet. There is barely any audio. Like, you can just hear some background noise. Let me turn this up. He's finally caught up to Liko Kenny. Liko is turning into what looks like a little turnaround on the right-hand side of the road. He's still not stopping. He eventually stops. Nothing is happening. No one's getting out of any cars right now. You see Liko Kenny lean out the window, look back. And that's all that's happening. The officer still hasn't gotten out of the car. There's no audio. The clock in the right-hand corner says 1911, which means 12, which means 7:11. It's still very bright if that is p.m. or a.m. I'm not sure. There's still nothing happening, or it's out of frame because all I could see is the top of Bruce McKay's vehicle and the rear of Liko Kenny's vehicle. No one has gotten out as far as I can tell. If it wasn't for the clock in the bottom right-hand corner, we wouldn't even know this was still live. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't even know what's going on right now. It's literally nothing. And it's just continuing that way. You can tell there are cars driving by on the main road. And a again, not much is happening. We're 3 minutes and 5 seconds into the video. I wish there was audio. Oh, and then he takes off. Liko Kenny is gone. He takes off in his car. Bruce McKay is still sitting there, probably wondering what the fuck just happened. And the car actually moves a little. I wonder if he was getting back in it. You know how you can tell, like, the car will move a little up and down when someone gets in? It's kind of what it did. Now he's finally in pursuit. Doesn't show how fast they're going. I wish it did, because to me it seems like they're kind of hauling ass. They're still on this little road. It looks like farmland. And he's finally catching up to him right now. We're at 4 minutes into the 7 minute and 21 second video. And I have seen this video before many times. I've never done a play-by-play, but here we are. And he's still chasing him, just down a straight country road. Liko's not trying to stop at all. Bruce McKay looks like he's pretty close to him. And he's going around him now on the left side, the cop is. It makes me... Oh, I would have thought he was going to do a pit maneuver, but he's actually just slowing down in front of Liko to stop him. So now he's stopped in the middle of the road, and I'm assuming Liko is behind him. But he's backing up now. The officer is. Is he running into Liko's car? Is he trying to outmaneuver him? This is so strange. So now he's making a 3 or 4 point turn across the highway. And he's going back the direction that he came. And Liko is still right there behind him. And now they're nose to nose. Their vehicles are nose to nose. And it looks like Liko Kenny is giving him the finger or pointing like he needs to go somewhere. I'm not sure what's happening. There is a car behind them on the road, also probably wondering what the hell is going on. Liko now backs into a little dirt parking lot. Bruce McKay is still on the road. And now he's going to pull into the dirt parking lot, right nose to nose with Liko Kenny's vehicle, and he actually hits the vehicle and pushes it backwards. You can tell. And again, he hits it and pushes it backwards, which is crazy. Now the audio comes on, and Bruce McKay pepper sprays Liko, and Liko just shoots at him 7 times. Oh my God. Oh, you can literally just hear it. Bruce McKay is not in the scene anymore. Liko Kenny and his passenger are still in the car. He backs up. He's backing up his car now. And Bruce McKay is out of the scene now, but the direction that he fell was right where Liko Kenny's car was heading. And if you know that he ran him over later when the records come out, then you know that that's the point of impact right then. And then the video is over. It's just so hard because it should never have happened. He was so scared during those moments. I've never seen anyone so scared in my entire life, said Caleb McCauley, Kenny's passenger. Can you imagine the terror that must be running through both of these men's minds? Especially Caleb. He's just been pepper sprayed, witnessed his friend shoot at a cop 7 times, then watched his friend run a cop down. Some random person comes along, shoots his friend who's in the driver's seat of a car he's in, and this is honestly too crazy to be true. I have seen movies with less plot than this. Some people in Franconia call Floyd a vigilante, but under New Hampshire law, the Attorney General found that Floyd was justified in using deadly force to protect McKay and himself. When asked if she believed Kenny got what he deserved, McKay's fiancée replied, "I can't answer that. I don't think anybody deserves a violent death." So that is the conclusion of the video portion. Now we'll go into a little background on Leeko Kenny and Bruce McKay. Both of these men lived in Franconia, New Hampshire, that has a population of 1,004 people. It's so small that there are only 3 full-time police officers for the town, which meant many people knew Bruce McKay. So we'll start there with Corporal Bruce McKay, born November 6, 1958, in Bronxville, New York. He was the son of Bruce and Catherine McKay, who graduated from Portledge High School in Locust Valley, New York, in 1976, and from New England College in Henniker, New Hampshire. Corporal McKay spent several years in the business world, working in the insurance and financial planning field with Prudential, and as a buyer for JCPenney and L.L. Bean. Before entering law enforcement, he had been employed with the Littleton Stamp and Coin Company. He was a volunteer firefighter and EMT since college. He had been a part-time officer with the Haverhill Police Department before joining the Franconia Police Department full-time September 1st, 1995. He was an officer and a prosecutor for the Franconia Department for 11 years. We'll get into that a little bit later. He was a loving father to one daughter, Courtney McKay, and had a fiance at the time of his death, Sharon Davis. His tenure and status at the police department literally divided this small town. There are people that are supporters of Bruce and see him as a hero, and there are people who didn't agree with who he was and what he stood for. McKay's fiance, Sharon Davis McKay, who took his name after his death, later said, "His idea was that everything was black and white. Either you are following the law or you weren't. There are no gray areas." Bruce McKay prosecuted some of the cases. So he would arrest someone, profit from the arrest by prosecuting them. That seems like one hell of a conflict of interest. One man, Timothy Stevenson, sued McKay in 2005, alleging that he used his prosecutor's role to settle scores. And at this point, I'm thinking he's kind of right. Both men settled their case with neither admitting blame. Unlike Massachusetts, New Hampshire does not have district attorneys and relies on police prosecutors to pursue guilty verdicts in minor crimes. So to earn extra money, McKay filled that position for the town as well. Sometimes when he would be trying a suspect in a case he'd arrested, he would put himself on the stand to present evidence. "I always thought he was a fascist," said Jean McLean. That impression wasn't eased by his Hitler mustache or the "gotcha" vanity license plate on his Nissan 4x4. McKay had an attitude. He was rough on people. She remembers once asking McKay to leave after he tried to shoo away some teenagers who were innocently playing hacky sack in front of her store. She called the killings vigilante justice. As it turns out, a good number of Franconia's 1,004 residents are not particularly cop-friendly. They trust their neighbors and want to decide for themselves which regulations to bother with. McKay seemed hell-bent on teaching these free-living citizens a few things about the rule of law. Chief Montemy does not keep arrest records subdivided by officer. But just for a little insight, on his last year on the job, McKay rang up over 300 stops, summary interrogations, drug searches, pursued every infraction, no matter how petty, with the same bulldog ferocity that he had always done. The other two full-time cops in the town collected 11 stops between them. Are you getting it here? Like, boy. So, obviously, Bruce McKay attracted a lot of talk in Franconia, and little of it was flattering. Once it was said he pulled over a 79-year-old woman for an expired registration sticker. She tried to explain that she was simply heading home to cook dinner for her husband. It's said that Bruce McKay made her wait in the car for over 2 hours. And to show you a kind of person Bruce McKay was, it was said that when he discovered a group of kids celebrating their high school graduation by frolicking along the river, he had every one of their cars towed. He threatened to ticket a man for driving his riding lawnmower across a road. Unfortunately, McKay's targets rarely filed complaints because people feared his retribution. They were afraid McKay would attack their kids, themselves, or their property. The police chief totally had his back. He calls McKay a dedicated officer who served the town and the department well. "We don't harass people," he says. He did his job, he did it well. Everyone was treated the same. He was knowledgeable and very professional and a dedicated police officer. We know that not everyone sees him this way. Pastor Gary Hart of Franconia Community Church said McKay's image as a law and order man in an old hippie town may have distanced himself from others. Yes, most of the time when people saw him, he was in his patrol vehicle, he was stopping people for speeding, doing things that law enforcement are supposed to do. But once you get a reputation in a small town, it's almost impossible to change it. So when people tell me he was difficult, that had not been my experience. There are definitely people out there who think Bruce McKay was a hard ass. He was somebody who was a stickler. Despite somewhat being perceived as a tough image, McKay was also known to help people out of the kindness of his heart. During more than 11 years on the force, Bruce McKay received 30 commendations. During that time, he also received 9 complaints about him. I was looking at his online obituary, and I'm going to read a few entries that stood out to me. "I hate that this happened. The years have not erased the feelings of that night. I was home in my kitchen with my scanner as white noise when all of a sudden something tuned me into the scanner. All of a sudden it wasn't white noise. Something was wrong. And during those initial seconds and minutes, which seemed like hours, I couldn't figure any of it out, but I knew that something was terribly wrong. It took me 18 minutes to make the usual 45-minute drive to Grafton. The rest, although totally impossible, I just never want to relive. My coworkers with solemn faces when I entered the office, the call from your father demanding answers, and us not being able to answer them. We had a direct order from the high sheriff that we not answer anything until appropriate people were informed, and in the proper manner of somewhat proper notification. In my mind, how does anyone handle that kind of notification? Properly. I not only remember you as 44K and your nightly notifications that you were 10-2 and on your way home on your motor pickle. If you call me in the next 20 minutes or so and I don't answer, it's just because I'm on my motor pickle. To the crazy conversation that started with, you sound like you're on the toilet. Yes, Bruce, I am. Dispatchers poop too. And of course, more importantly than work, when our daughters began kindergarten together and the playdates that Courtney came to for our house, when our girls began kindergarten way back when, they were best friends from the start. We stood in that crazy kindergarten classroom, both of us with tears in our eyes, noticing instantly that our girls had become good friends. For some strange, inexplicable reason, we both just knew that things were going to be okay when we left them unsupervised to play. There are very few days, even now, that I don't think of you. Sometimes license plates make me remember your early days in Lisbon. Your plate was "Fess Up." You are thought of fondly by many. I wish I had the chance to meet Sharon. I'm certain that we would have shared many chuckles. This is a rough time of year for many of us, both personally and professionally. Rest in the utmost peace, Bruce. I know that you are with some of the best, and knowing you, you insisted on bringing your motor pickle. Judy Wetherell, Dispatcher, May 11th, 2011. May you stay forever young. Bruce McKay, Father, November 6th, 2020. Bruce, I will never forget you. It has been almost 13 years since that tragic day. I remember clear as day after we talked. We both waved goodbye and said, "See you later, my friend." Later that same day, after I saw you, you were gone. I cherished our friendship and the brother and sisterhood we all shared working law enforcement in the North County of New Hampshire. I'm still on the job and loving every minute of it. It's the memory of you and heroes like you that keep me and my fellow brother and sister law enforcement officers out here every day fighting evil and the savages that take the life of a law enforcement officer like you. The price of peace and freedom is eternal vigilance, and we will remain as such, just as you did that fateful day. Rest easy, my friend, as we will meet again someday and share another smile and a friendly wave. Your Sergeant of the New Hampshire Law Enforcement, April 27th, 2020. Dear brother, you would be proud that Franconia finally got a decent police and fire station built. It's quite an impressive building with all of the proper setups you would expect. Your photo is framed and hung there, and the guys who knew you certainly think of you often. By the way, the chief looks very much like you. Kind of gives me the chills, actually. I had to do a double take. Miss you more than I can say in words. Thanks for sending all of your signs. I love them, and they keep me going. Megan McKay Wright, Sister, October 3rd, 2016. Now let's talk about Liko Peter Kenny. Liko Kenny was born in the Littleton Hospital on April 26, 1983, and lived in Easton. Liko attended Franconia Elementary and Profile Schools, spending winters homeschooled in Hawaii. Later, he transferred to Pine Ridge School in Williston, Vermont. Liko was an open-hearted, free-spirited person. He loved to be outdoors. He loved four-wheeling on the family property. Hiking, gardening, and being with his friends were some of his favorite pastimes. His aspiration in life was to be self-sufficient in agriculture. To live in a fair and just world was his ultimate desire. When Rob Hayward, one of Kenny's friends, looks at the video, he sees a young guy who's been harassed a number of times and really believed, because he told us that they were out to get him. Kenny often expressed these fears to Cheryl Brousseau, a co-worker at a local nursery where Kenny worked. He said that something was going to happen. When I first met him, he told me he was not going to live past 30. Always in the back of his mind, there was someone harassing him. Nevertheless, she said, Kenny always seemed happy. Every day I saw him, he was happy, funny, told millions of jokes. He was a gardener. He planted for his mother and raised baby chicks and fish. He was kind of just a happy, hippie kid. He'd do anything to help anyone, said Holly Hayward, 48, who said she'd known Kenny his whole life. The place Liko was headed, Tamarack, was started in 1962 by the family's patriarch, Jack Kenny, a serious student of the tennis game who taught strokes by painstakingly breaking down their essential elements. It was the first tennis camp in New England, and it drew prep schoolers from all over the Northeast. Many alumni maintain an unswerving allegiance. "Oh God, it was magical," says George Gibson. It wasn't fancy, but it had an old-fashioned, rustic life that was really terrific for a lot of kids. Along with tennis, the Kinney Camp offered swimming, crafts, and a penny-ante gambling night called Newport Casino. A fair amount of goofing off happened as well. Then, as the 1960s kicked into high gear, there was more. A counterculture, fiercely loving, freedom-loving spirit that has never left the camp. There were 5 Kinney children altogether, every one of them involved with Tamarack in some kind of way, and they all caught the freedom bug. Or were they the cause of it? Like any virus, it mutated in different forms. For Bubba, the second youngest, it manifested in daredevil stunts. Bubba was not afraid of death or dying, his older brother says. He was fearless. As a teenager, Bubba dove off bridges without checking the depth of the river below, leading to a constellation of scars on his forehead. Early one spring, he went kayaking in Franconia in Notch's Echo Lake as soon as the ice had broken up. And when his kayak flipped over, he drowned in the frigid waters at age 25. The same spirit emerged in the most famous Kenny of all, Liko's cousin, the brilliant combustible skier, Bodie Miller. He bailed Liko out of jail once and had his own run-in with Bruce McKay, receiving a $500 speeding ticket for driving 83 in a 40-mile-per-hour zone in 2005. Miller left the set of a Nike commercial to contest the ticket, mostly to antagonize Bruce McKay. He got the fine cut in half, so I guess that's something. Bodie's got the Kinney anger, says his Uncle Bill. That is a real powerful energy source for him, but he channels it into his ski races. In Miller's headlong plunges down the mountain, speed always comes first, control second, just like most of the Kinney children. Liko's father, Davey, wore his hair to his waist and had a jewelry maker wife, which just sounds like hippie heaven. They raised their son in a log cabin down by the Tamarack soccer field. They spent winters in Hawaii, homeschooling Liko and teaching him to savor the independence that came with their live and let live philosophy. That upbringing developed Liko a conception of freedom that was a kind of entitlement, a set of expectations that more often goes with wealth. Except with Liko, it went with the land. He was so attached to the family's mountainside paradise, he thought of it as his birthright. Unfortunately for Liko, all the other Kennys felt the same way, his Uncle Bill especially. He was a survivalist and an eco-purist who was raised beefalo, I don't know what the fuck that is, and was a logger. Bill lived alone in a 2-story log cabin for 30 years. About 5 years before this, he had had enough of solitude and acquired I'm not going to pretend to pronounce this correctly, Kyrgyzstanian, he got a mail order bride. That's what we're throwing out. Bill loved the silence around his house and he hated anything gas powered. That led to big problems when Liko started joyriding around the Kenny property on his ATV, roaring down a trail that Bill regarded as his private road. "It drove me nuts," Bill said. One day in late 2002, Bill brought a tree down across an access trail and blocked Liko's joyriding path. Love it. On the second day of the new year, Liko retaliated by chainsawing a 40-foot-tall pine tree down on Bill's house. Larissa, awoken from a nap by the noise, rushed outside to find Liko cutting down many more trees. She snapped pictures of what he was doing, and Liko made a grab for her camera, then chased her to her sister-in-law's house next door. She was terrified. The next day, she took out a restraining order that would keep Liko 100 feet from her and off the property Bill claimed altogether. It was only 3 weeks after that he had his first major altercation with Bruce McKay. On Wednesday, May 16th, Bruce McKay's flag-draped casket lay in state in Franconia's Grand Town Hall. Not long before he died, he designed special gold-accented dress uniforms for occasions like this, and the department's two remaining full-time members wore them proudly. To pay their respects, police and firefighters gathered from all over New England, assembling a 500-strong person parade through the town while a bagpipe and drum corps played Amazing Grace. A few days later, despite a driving rain, several hundred turned out to mourn Liko Kenny at a service on the Tamarack soccer field, where they burned sage and sang the Katie Lang song, Simple, about the beautiful struggle that we're in. Liko had always wanted his remains to be put atop Mount Kinsman, high above Tamarack, for coyotes to feast on. But Davy and Michelle decided to bury him alongside his Uncle Bubba in what the Kinneys referred to as the Big Circle, a ring of stones that sits up past Joe's place and serves as the family cemetery. For all his good intentions, Liko Kenny drove a wedge into his family that his death may only have widened. As it often had before, it all goes back to the land. Jack and his wife Peg left their 450 acres of property to their four surviving children to share in equally. However, Bill's feuding with Liko over his ATV riding convinced Bill that he wanted to carve out a parcel that was solely his, and he's hired a lawyer to extract his share. His siblings have retained lawyers too, and now the dispute is in court, with the possible result being that Tamarack will wind up in the hands of a developer, which no one has ever wanted. There are other tensions simmering at the camp as well. The other Kennys have grown so angry at the Millers for their role in Liko's prosecution, they have made it known that they want the family out. Liko Kenny has split the larger community too, dividing Franconia into McKay people and Kenny people, a schism so wide that a group of residents has formed the Franconia Recovery and Reconciliation Committee to try to patch things up. That, however, is unlikely to happen anytime in the foreseeable future. Honestly, the closer you look at McKay and Kenny, the less different they seem, each asserting his authority so fiercely it borders on self-righteousness. And for the town, it may not be that the dividing line runs between the two camps, but within them, in the beautiful struggle between the craving for order and the lust for freedom that McKay and Kenny literally died to express. The end result of all of this madness is that two people are dead, two people that were dearly loved and hated, in some cases, by the community, their family, their friends, and nothing will bring them back. David Kenny sued in 2010, saying McKay stopped Kenny's car without cause and used excessive force. He said his son and McKay had a strained relationship dating back to 2003, when McKay first arrested him. Judges on the case noted that Kenny, whose registration was expired, had driven away when McKay first stopped his car. The judge said McKay was justified in using his cruiser to push Kenny's car off the road, and he was justified in pepper spraying him during the subsequent approach. The courts have consistently held that the use of pepper spray is reasonable when the target is either resisting arrest or refusing to obey an officer's request. His judgment was denied. He can appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it's unlikely that he will, because it's reported that he now lives in Hawaii and has not been able to be reached for comment. So here we are at the end of this wild ride with so many twists and turns, and feel free to watch the video. It's haunting to know that these are the last moments that either of these men will be alive. The other videos I'll post as well. I think it's just shocking how this concluded and how this all went down. I don't think it had to happen this way. I think both of these men were stubborn and just wanted things how they wanted them. I hope maybe people can learn something from this. Maybe a little more tolerance. Maybe a lot less aggro. I'm not sure, but thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. And I will be back next week with another crazy ass case.